So last week, someone familiar with the Trump campaign's internal polling from March, sorry.
That's your cold open. That was like a cartoon burp.
It really was.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The lineups for the first Democratic primary debates are set. 20 candidates made the cut, and they'll be debating on consecutive nights next week. The Democratic National Committee tried to ensure that there would be an even spread of top-level candidates across the two nights, but it doesn't really look like it worked. So we're going to discuss what the lineups mean for how the debates will play out. Also, President Trump is kicking off his re-election campaign this week in Orlando. A recent study showed that during the first 2 years of the Trump presidency, 15% of Americans shifted their views of the president one way or another. So we're going to discuss the question of who exactly persuadable voters are in 2020. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going well.
Welcome back from Brazil.
Yeah. At this point, 24 hours ago, I was on a beach called Ipanema Beach.
I was in Amsterdam.
Sipping a beer with the penguin logo. And here I am at the podcast, and it's
and this is
equally,
just so much
equally
better.
Good.
But you're
so
not
much
jet
better.
Lagged, right? Because it's the same.
No, let me make a little promo for Latin America. Folks, if you don't like jet lag and you want to like go to Latin America, then go to Latin America.
First of all,
I'm convinced.
American that live read for the Latin American Tourism Board.
Yeah.
No, but I'm surprised that people don't realize like it's so nice to be able to go to like Peru or Brazil or Colombia, which I haven't been to, and like not have to deal with jet lag. If you can sleep on planes, you can literally do like a 3-day weekend. It's quite plausible.
All right. Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone.
Hi. I was in New York over the weekend where I live.
Is there any place around the world you'd like to plug before we move on to Micah?
No, I'll remain neutral today.
All right. Switzerland.
Yes, Switzerland.
And also here with us is managing editor Micah Cohen. Welcome back. We missed
Thank you. Thank you. I missed you guys too.
Micah would like to plug the Jersey Shore.
Well, any place you would like to plug?
I was in Brooklyn over the weekend, which I was saying before the show, which I feel like me going to Brooklyn is the equivalent for me of Nate going to South America.
This is Micah just like playing up how much of like a terrible Manhattanite he is.
Yeah, you're like wildly parochial.
No, I just like.
I was actually in Manhattan two nights this weekend, which is extremely rare for me.
See?
So we switched places.
It goes both ways, yeah.
But only in the,
except that she comes to Manhattan every day of the week almost.
Yeah.
Well, it's not my fault.
I'm sorry, I'm more well-rounded.
Latin American Travel Association, reach out to us if you want to sponsor the show, though.
All right, we are going to get into the two topics I just mentioned, but before we do, let's ask one of our favorite questions, good use of polling or bad use of polling, and today's example comes courtesy of a leaker in Trump world. So last week, someone familiar with the Trump campaign's internal polling from March leaked Trump's head-to-head numbers against Joe Biden in key states, and they gave that data to ABC News, The New York Times, and other outlets as well. The polling showed Biden leading Trump by 16 points in Pennsylvania, 10 points in Wisconsin, and 7 points in Florida, and the list goes on as well. The campaign has since cut ties with 3 of its 5 pollsters. So I know that you're not mind readers. I don't think that you were in the room when all of this happened. But if we could hypothesize, why did somebody leak such bad numbers for Trump, who was presumably involved in some way?
It's the deep state.
In the polling process, or know somebody involved in the polling process.
I mean, maybe they wanted to prove how much of an idiot they were for bothering to poll the horse race in June and the year before the election. I mean, so head-to-head polls don't really mean very much right now.
Mm-hmm.
And internal polls, I think, are one of the most overrated things that is covered by the media, right? In general, these internal polls are always meant to spin some angle or another. You know, you don't usually get a lot of information on what they actually said when you read a rumored characterization of internal polls. I mean, gosh, people have enough trouble characterizing what public polls say. And so for us, a poll is useful. We actually, in our congressional forecasts, use internal polls if you actually give the details of which pollster conducted it, what the dates were, what the sample frame was, whatever else, then that's fine, right? But so that's my general prior is like, I'm not really sure that this is much of a news story.
Right. So I understand the perspective that the data is not useful. But I guess the use of polling that we might key in on here is somebody used this poll by leaking it. What were they trying to accomplish, or what were they potentially trying to accomplish?
To give some clicks to websites on a slow news week? No, I don't know. Look, I think they're
whoever leaked it obviously had some kind of personal motivation for it, right?
So the way this unfolded was the New York Times, I think, had a story about Trump freaking out about internal polls that reportedly showed him down to Biden in a bunch of states. Then George Stephanopoulos in that ABC interview with Trump asked Trump about it, and Trump was like, those don't exist. You know, I'm beating everyone everywhere. And then ABC News got some of the top line data, and then other people got the data. So I wonder if it was leaking the actual data, because the original leak was about Trump's reaction, really, right?
Yeah, but the only reason why you would leak the poll is to be like, no, this guy is wrong and the polls are really bad for him, which to me doesn't indicate a person fully in support of the person that they're doing polling for.
No, totally. But that's why the simplest explanation is that they were sort of leaking it to show that these actually existed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is it also potentially somebody being like, hey, Trump, you need to pay attention on what your numbers look like and try to improve them?
I mean, sometimes people leak stuff because, yeah, they want to scare the candidate straight. Sometimes they leak stuff because they are kind of like a false flag. And maybe if you're one part of the Trump polling operation and they have like a lot of different pollsters that work for them and you want to like somehow make someone else look bad, then maybe you can get your rival within the campaign fired. Sometimes people leak stuff just because they like to share and they like to gossip, and you're drinking buddies with someone and you promise them a scoop in exchange for some reciprocal treatment later on, or not, because you're their buddy. I do think the intrinsic value of like how much we actually learn from internal polls at this point in time is quite low. And obviously, most of the time you hear internal polls leaked, they tend to have more favorable numbers for the campaign. And is it Brad Parscale? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes.
He's the running Trump's reelection campaign, at least on the data side. He reacted in kind of a way that I thought was funny, which is he's like, oh, those were real numbers from March, and now things have shifted dramatically. I mean, nothing shifted that dramatically. If you look at kind of Trump's approval ratings, it's always around 42, 41. It's kind of bobbed up to 42.5 or 42.7 now or something like that, right? Like, not that much has shifted. That was a kind of a very strange reaction. But in general, I think a campaign is wasting its money if it, like, spends a lot of money on internal polls right now.
Well, the interesting thing, though, because I tend to agree with Nate that this was sort of much ado about not much for a while, but reportedly now Trump is sort of firing/exiling three of his pollsters in response to all this. So it could have real consequences for the campaign.
Yeah, although I think they're still working for like one of his packs, so it's not clear how.
Two are going to one of the packs, but one, I think, the person associated with the polling company, which is like Kellyanne Conway's thing, is, as of now, not going anywhere, reportedly.
And these are fairly well-reputed pollsters that he let go, right? In my opinion, it probably does Trump a lot of good to have these kind of more traditional, long-standing Republican pollsters willing to work for him. Trump, I thought, actually did a good job in 2016 with where he spent time in the states, so credit to Brad Parscale for that. I do think in his more recent communications, he's kind of become a guy who seems like he's drinking the Kool-Aid a lot, and like that's a big risk for Trump. I would think that, like, whether it's Kellyanne Conway or I don't know, whomever, right, somebody can say when it is relevant, which is not in June of 2019, right, but when it's September of 2020, and someone's like, you're going to lose to Elizabeth Warren unless you kind of change your tone, right? I would hope someone could say that instead of trying to spin and say, okay, well, the public polls have you 4 points down, but we all know those polls are off and our polls have you ahead. Like, that's like literally the least helpful thing to a candidate. And so the fact that Trump can't maybe take that kind of advice. Although, let's be fair, though, man. I mean, if someone was leaky and they were sending this stuff out to all these reporters, then like I can understand why someone would be fired.
Fair enough. But I do think one of the big takeaways here is like, what message does this send to other people on the Trump campaign's data team about delivering bad news to the president? Because even before he fired these people, or reportedly fired or exiled or whatever, these people, he was really pissed about the numbers, and his team was like doing work to get him a kind of better spin on those numbers.
Before we wrap up here, I do want to circle back to the topic of head-to-head polling at this point in the race anyway. So say we believe these internal polls, that the data is solid. We don't know if it is. We don't know what the methodology was exactly, et cetera, as Nate mentioned. Even if it was, and again, this is also only Joe Biden, how accurate generally are polls conducted a year and a half in advance of the general election?
so accurate.
You wouldn't believe. You wouldn't believe. Yeah, wouldn't believe. In fact,
not at all accurate. So Perry looked at this last week, following up on something. Harry, R.I.P.
To clarify, he's not dead. He just works for CNN.
I mean, what's the difference? And Harry had looked at this running up in the run up to 2016. But basically, we looked at every election we had polling for going back to 1944. And polls in November and December of the year before the election. So we're not even talking about now. We're talking about like 5 months from now. Mm-hmm. Had an average absolute error of 11 percentage points.
It's not the margin of error. The margin of error is about 2.5 times that, so 25 points.
Right, right. So it's sort of like it's inexact to the point of uselessness. And some years, the absolute error, again, not the margin of error, was like 30 points. And this is, again, polls of the eventual actual matchup. We don't even know what the actual matchup is going to be yet. So I don't know that people shouldn't do general election polls now.
But the people who look at them shouldn't take them seriously.
There are a couple of issues here. One is that if you're measuring the president's approval rating, that can shift a lot within a year or a year and a half to the point where the presidential approval ratings 2 years beforehand at the midterm are like not predictive at all of what they are going to be actually at the general election, right? So that side of it can shift. Side number two is you don't know who the nominee is, and their popularity can shift a lot. We saw periods, and if you look at the whole trajectory of the 2016 race, there were periods where Hillary Clinton at the start of the race was quite popular and then became deeply unpopular by the end of the race. And so the stage that the election is in terms of how well-known the candidate is and kind of are they a target of incoming fire from one party, from both parties, neither, both, whatever, that's pretty important. You know, and three, like, again, name recognition to be a little bit repetitive is something which can matter a lot. Maybe in the abstract, a Biden versus Trump poll is a little bit more meaningful than like a Buttigieg versus Trump poll.
If you look at the years when polling this far out was a little more accurate, I haven't like studied this systematically, but I was just looking through the years. And it tends to be years, as Nate was just getting at, where both candidates had really high name recognition really early. So if it does eventually end up being Biden versus Trump, you would kind of expect, okay, the polls would have an easier time picking up on the eventual contours of the race because Biden's so well known and Trump is so well known.
All right, so let's move on to our next topic. But how do we want to label that? Was the leaking of that internal polling a good use of polling or a bad use of polling?
All right, how about this? Bad use of polling for just doing the poll and doing a general election poll. Do some other polls.
Wait, for what? For Trump's campaign, what else are they going to poll?
They should like
him against Bill Weld?
No, they should like I'm sure they are doing this, but they should be like testing messages identifying voters and blah, 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 blah.
Or you could test liabilities for the Democrats. You can kind of try to figure out like, is there messages you want to drive on Biden? Should he be the opponent or Warren? Should she be whatever else?
Okay, so bad use for the substance of the poll.
For the focus on a general election matchup poll, I say good use for leaking it because the President of the United States had lied about...
We're pro-leaks.
Yeah, we're journalists, one. But also, the President had lied about this polling existing, so it corrected the record.
There we go. We've got a good use and a bad use in the same example. Let's move on and talk about the Democratic primary debates. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Finding a new job is a lot of work. But what if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job? Now ZipRecruiter's technology can do just that for you. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app, let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know, so if you're interested in the job, you can apply. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app. And based on a third-party survey, 7 out of 10 people who found a new job on ZipRecruiter increased their salaries. Those were the results of a 2017 U.S. survey of over 500 ZipRecruiter users who got hired for a job they found on ZipRecruiter. Download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. Don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job. The first Democratic primary debates are scheduled for next Wednesday and Thursday, and the lineups were determined last Friday. The Democratic National Committee wanted to ensure that both nights would have equal importance and that there would not be a JV and a varsity debate. So they chose the lineup semi-randomly, but ensured that candidates polling over 2% would be evenly divided across the two nights. And here are the lineups. Wednesday night is Warren, Booker, Klobuchar, O'Rourke, Castro, de Blasio, Delaney, Gabbard, Inslee, and Ryan. And then Thursday night is Biden, Sanders, Harris, Buttigieg, Yang, Gillibrand, Hickenlooper, Bennett, Williamson, Swalwell. I think I finally learned how to pronounce all those names correctly.
I believe it's Swalwell.
So let's start with this. Did the DNC's qualifying criteria work as intended?
Well, it doesn't seem like the main attractions or the top pollers are evenly split up between the two nights. Night one seems to have become sort of de facto the quote-unquote JV debate, although you could point out that, like, Elizabeth Warren's perhaps pretty stoked to be the only top-tier contender on that night.
Wait,
you know?
Is she?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's... We're gonna have a little argument.
We should have a fight about. I think Nate's gonna argue that
people won't watch the first night.
Yeah, you'd rather be in the sort of like big time,
or like she won't get to show off her, you know, debating skills. Like,
you guys, I would just put down that there's no debate. They're all gonna talk for probably
That's
5 minutes
think.
Total,
That's
and it doesn't like it doesn't matter. Well, I don't know.
Okay, so let's get a little bit more into whether or not this is good for Warren, who this is good or bad for. But before we do that, first of all, can we put some numbers to how this attempt to divide up the top polling candidates did?
So when this all came out, Nathaniel and Jeff Skelly from our politics team basically looked at the average of polls that the DNC used for qualification and just kind of summed up each night's support. Night one, 21 percentage points of support, average support, 2 points. Night two, 64 total percentage points of support, average support, 6.5 points. So it's like a big disparity. Now, there was always going to be somewhat of a disparity because of Biden, but this is like a pretty big disparity. Actually, our quantitative editor, Laura Bronner, was like playing around with the data and found that this distribution of support is among the most lopsided you could have had possible.
It's like the 90th.
Are you telling us that unlikely things happen?
It's not to say it was unlikely. It's just to say that like this is like really lopsided relative to what was possible. So in that sense, the DNC didn't get what it wanted, purportedly. I do think they got what they wanted, or I don't know, maybe I'd put it to you guys, in terms of having an inclusive first debate that still left a couple people out, or should... I go back and forth on this, like in terms of not which night the people are in, but just in terms of who qualified, do you feel like the DNC is happy?
I think everyone would probably be happier if there were fewer people in the debates. So the DNC probably isn't happy that this many people are running for president and met their qualification standards. I don't know if that's the answer we were looking for.
I mean, the question is, did they actually encourage people to run when they set these relatively low thresholds? Yeah. And I don't know. It would seem like the DNC, by having for the third presidential debate, which will be hosted by our partners at ABC News, they up the standards quite a bit. That would kind of cut half the field out. And so I think that's kind of a tacit acknowledgement that, like, maybe this was too loose. I also think they would probably say, you know what? We probably want Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, debating if we had our druthers. There's no criteria for experience. We would not necessarily want Marianne Williamson or someone debating. So they try to be inclusive and, like, you know, I've criticized the DNC for some stuff that they've done. One thing is I would actually prefer to have had an actual JV debate and a heavyweights debate, and I'm not sure why they were so reluctant to do that. But that aside, like, no matter what they would do, they were going to get criticized.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be, by the way, that the parties did not have a role and it was up to the network. So ABC News would decide who they want in their debate and NBC in their debate and whatever else. Maybe it's better, honestly. That way the party isn't like looking like it's trying to set the rules. It's hard to set objective criteria to kind of match your kind of subjective view of what should be in without looking like you're kind of putting your finger on the scale.
Now that we've discussed the structure of the first debate, let's get into the actual substance. Claire, you started to say that Warren was probably happy that she was, well, let's just say she is the only top five candidate on Wednesday night, the first night. So, Claire, you were saying that she's probably happy about that. Can you lay out the argument for why that would be good for Warren, or what the advantages are as you see them?
Well, I mean, the advantage is that she's not competing with any, with multiple other headliners. That could be the pro side argument. And so in a debate where people probably only get to speak for a few minutes, she could potentially be the person who people know already. Let's assume that she performs pretty well because she does this stuff a lot in the form of like town halls and she stumps all the time, that she comes off and people are kind of like, oh yeah, Elizabeth Warren really commanded that debate stage. She was the person I was impressed by, whatever. And then there were some other people that I kind of knew. I also don't think that she's like a person who Democrats are going to attack. Like, I think the second night could have the potential for people to kind of come at Biden, say, as one of the more moderate people. So if you're looking for an upside for Warren in the first night debate, it's that she's kind of the big kahuna.
What do you guys think about that?
I mean, okay, I have a fairly elaborate theory.
Is there a 1A, 1B, 1C?
So I think there are like four tiers of candidates, right?
Okay, but we know what those are.
So
okay.
Here, first of all, I think this debate,
which debate
is a moment, this first debate, or these first sets of debates, are a moment of potential vulnerability for Joe Biden, who has been atop the polls by a pretty good margin since he began running. But traditionally, kind of in debates, the candidates who are the favorites or the front runners, the first debates are moments of vulnerability for them, where it gives candidates kind of literal equal status on a stage with them. This is more of a guess. I do not think Biden is going to be an especially good debater, although he has some experience. He did the VP debates, obviously, but like...
Yeah, he hasn't been that good in past debates.
Yeah, I think he's probably a... I mean, I think, frankly, they're probably, you know, probably a C-plus debater. And I think the media narrative is relative...
Where did that come
based
from?
On what?
Yeah.
Truly.
Based on I watch these debates. What do you mean? You think he's going to be like an A-plus?
Well, I'm thinking about like the last two like marquee presidential debates he's had to do, vice presidential debates. The Sarah Palin one, his sort of task was to not look like a bully to her.
He was okay in that one.
Yeah, but his task was sort of to be like, people kind of knew she didn't have a great grasp of policy, and he was supposed to be to convey the idea that he was knowledgeable without coming across as a bully.
Or condescending.
Condescending. Or, yeah. And I think, I mean, the Paul Ryan one I honestly don't remember as well.
Because I'm looking back now on this CBS News instant poll that had Biden winning 50%, Ryan 31%. So I guess people at the time, maybe expectations are too low. But like, I think there is also a thing where like the media is ready for like a change in the story from Biden's a front runner. Frankly, it's been pretty boring the past couple of months. Thank you for listening to the podcast through these boring times. We're getting into very exciting
times. Click on our ads.
But anyway, so here's my theory. Biden as the front runner probably wants to avoid any of the other top tier candidates. You kind of can't mathematically, right? But you'd rather kind of have it seem like the clown car approach, where there are many Democrats who are kind of like de Blasio or something taking like wild swings at him, and he is kind of on a pedestal and elevated and just can like be the nice guy, right? And not deal with the more formidable opponents, some of whom are potentially pretty good debaters.
So you're saying the setup is bad for Biden?
I think he would rather have been in Warren's position, you know?
The thing I genuinely don't know, but the thing that I think sounds wrong to me about that, Nate, is that supposes that the way these debates affect the election is like quite literal and about what transpires on stage and what transpires between whom and how. So in other words, like to exaggerate that understanding of how it would work, it would be like, if on night one, Cory Booker does a really good job of attacking Amy Klobuchar, then we will see after the debate Booker's polls rise at the expense of Klobuchar. Obviously, you're not saying it works that way, but to me, it's like these debates are all about who has a good moment, who has good media coverage coming out of them, and therefore probably don't depend that much to what Claire was saying earlier about there's not really that much back and forth. It's mostly just the candidates talking. They don't really depend that much on who's in which debate. Does that make sense? It's more just like who performs well, who knocks a question out of the
park.
I mean,
we're probably talking about like something, the draw that affects someone's odds of winning the nomination by 0.1% or something, right? We're not talking about...
But don't you form your perception of who somebody is relative to everyone else? Like, isn't that why people are saying Biden is a moderate? Because everyone else is on... We talked about this in a recent podcast where Nate was saying that, well, objectively, he's a liberal. But when you're on stage with a bunch of people who are, you know, further to the left, then, of course, you seem more moderate in comparison. And your behavior on stage, not just in policies, but also in demeanor and style, are going to be viewed in comparison to everybody else.
Yeah, that's fair. And so, like, if Warren, if we're saying that Warren has been paired with, like, the also-ran candidates, maybe that helps there. But I'm not sure that the support translates into, like, how someone looks on stage as a debater. In other words, like, some of these people who are getting less than 1% in the polls might still be really good on stage.
Yeah, I mean, like, the first night debate does have a potential for it to be for someone to, like, steal the show from Warren, right? Like, what if, I mean, if you're someone like Jay Inslee or, I guess, Klobuchar or Booker, who have been getting less attention, you're probably super happy to be in that debate, I would think, because to me it's like there's more of a chance to, like, steal the gold star from the front runner and to, like, have a bit of a breakout moment rather than get lost in the morass of what potentially the second night debate could be, which is, like, Joe Biden is too moderate.
The first debate has a lot of underachievers, people who have interesting resumes, got a lot of hype when they entered the race, but who have not really performed that well. So I think all these people, I mean, obviously Beto has been in a world of hurt lately in terms of his polls and his media narrative. Booker, I think, should be a very capable debater. Klobuchar should be a very capable debater. Castro is a candidate who I don't understand why he hasn't gained more traction, and Inslee's another one. You know, so that's kind of the group, and Gillibrand in the second night would be in that group. She's the kind of one exception. But so, like, if you look at not the polls, but kind of how much raw talent there is, I think the first night is not that easy. And you could very easily imagine if Booker does well, or Beto, or any of these, Castro, right, that people could say, hey, look, kind of fundamentally, these are interesting candidates, and how come they have not been getting more attention? And, you know, Klobuchar is a former prosecutor. She's probably a pretty good debater. Booker's a very good extemporaneous speaker. So I don't know. I think it's, like, not necessarily, like, an easy task for Warren.
So do you disagree? We've kind of established that potentially Biden has something to lose going the second night and that he can take jabs from the other top-level candidates that night. Do you agree or disagree with Claire about Warren being happy with with going on the first night?
He disagrees.
I disagree, because I think, like, she actually has other opponents who could become the story of night one, right? But there are certainly ways where it could work out for her. One way it could work out nicely is if it looks like Biden is being attacked from all sides and holds up relatively well, then it could look like, okay, she's the one who sailed through, was focused on policy, didn't have to get personal, whatever else, was the bigger woman, bigger person, and that the other debate's kind of this food fight. That could make her look good. Right. So if there's, like, an ugly, scrappy second debate, then, okay, and maybe Castro has a breakout moment. Okay, you can live with that. Right. So, I mean, again, this is pretty marginal effects. But in general, she has been rising in the polls and in people's estimation. So now at prediction market, she is the second most likely Democrat to win after Biden, an assessment that I think I tend to agree with, actually. So it's, like, kind of this moment where, well,
just
who
drop
else?
That in there. Just add that little aside.
Would you rather take Bernie?
No, I said over the
Should
weekend.
Take Mayor Pete?
I said over the weekend that if you squint at recent polls, you could almost convince yourself that Warren is in second place now.
Yeah.
You have to squint, and it's almost, but still.
So maybe this is a little bit of an addendum to our last week's podcast where we debated whether or not she was surging. That kind of advantage in the polls seemed to become clearer in the time since. But go ahead, Claire.
So let me ask a question for the people around this table, all of whom will be live blogging this debate.
That is a plug for the live blog, folks.
Both and many nights. Other news organizations will be doing the same.
But we'll be doing it better.
How much effect do we think our live blogs and the write-ups of the debates will factor in polling over the ensuing couple of weeks following that debate, given that I'm assuming that not everyone in America will be watching the two-night extravaganza? So I'm asking, how much are our fingers on the scales?
It's, I think, maybe the most difficult events to cover if you're a part of the media, because, like, the media perception influences a lot of it. We have a, can we announce the thing we're doing?
Let's announce it here and now.
Yeah, so we actually have a somewhat surprise in store, which I'm ruining. So we're going to be partnering with Morning Consult. We have, with their help, designed polling around the debate. One thing we're trying to see, actually, is, so how much of who people think won the debate or perform well has to do with who voters liked ahead of time versus who actually changed minds. So we're doing, I think, different types of polling than people have seen ordinarily. It will not be ready night of, but I think we're going to actually say, okay, here's our view as in these 10-person debates, we're kind of reduced to playing the role of pundits. And I think we'll try to do that by, like, number one, being aware of the media circus around a debate and how our judgments can matter. And number two, to have kind of a sense of humor about it, not take it super seriously. But we are going to, the next morning after each debate, have a bunch of innovative polling about how people did. We may even be able to look at kind of how things evolve over time. Was there a split in how people who reacted right after the debate reacted versus people who got up the next morning and then read news about the debates and how that might have changed? I mean, I do feel like Warren might have been in a moment where if she'd had a really good debate, then people would be ready to crown her as like, oh, actually, maybe she's not number two. Maybe she's actually the most likely Democrat to win if Biden had seemed vulnerable or whatever else. And now she can't have that direct path. I mean, who really cares, right? It's June. Maybe being coronated the front runner in June is not that important or maybe even harmful in some ways.
So to answer your question, Claire, about the role that the media plays in perceptions of the debate, it does play a role.
Yeah, it's a huge role. Even if you just look at how many people watch the debate, I think most voters encounter the debate through the media, not through the debate itself. But I'm not sure there's anything to do about that, except be conscious of it for ourselves, right? And then, as Nate was saying, we, as part of it, we cover how the media is covering the debate. Is that what you think? You think it has a big effect or no?
I just wanted to provoke conversation and thought.
You know who I think had the worst draw for the debate? Buttigieg. I think Mayor Pete would have really benefited from kind of being in Warren's position more, where I think he'll get crowded out somewhat by the heavy hitters.
He's also on stage with many older people,
but
the other thing
is, like, for people like, say, Gillibrand, someone who could, like, put herself in contrast with Biden and kind of have a breakout moment, or Buttigieg, who could be like, I'm kind of making a similar argument to Biden, but look, I'm young. Ish. That could be like a positive thing. You could argue up and down for like literally every person for where they, for the spot they have
for being good or bad.
For being good or bad. Yeah.
No, and when this came out, our Politics Slack channel like erupted in takes.
It's like a real Rorschach test. Full disclosure, I don't love live blogging things. I don't know if I should say that. But I do actually think that this is going to be a really interesting watch because it'll be interesting to see what people's strategies are. Like, if they're going to come out and just sort of, like, ignore everyone else on stage and introduce themselves to America. Or if they're going to, like, come out...
Guns blazing.
Yeah.
Who are you most interested to see?
Well, I'm like, a lot of people. Like, I'm curious to see whether O'Rourke just does his, like, O'Rourke thing where he's really earnest on stage and that's kind of what he's hoping people remember, like the telegenic, earnest message. I guess I'm probably most interested in how Klobuchar and Booker comport themselves because they are those kind of cuspy tier people. And yeah. I'm looking to see if Inslee, who I think is like super qualified, has a singular message for his campaign, is kind of like an interesting candidate in that respect. I'm kind of curious if he provokes stuff on stage.
Those were O'Rourke and Klobuchar were my two. Nate, who on that one?
I mean, let's go with the Klobe.
Okay.
Since I wrote her how Amy Klobuchar can win the nomination.
Char. Say it together, people. Char.
I think her strategy relied fairly explicitly on being good at the debates as someone who has certainly been good in scenarios where there's like Senate testimony and questioning and whatnot, has a prosecutor's background, can in theory be kind of personable and funny. I mean, I think this is a big moment for her. And on the second night, I'm really curious about Harris because I'm curious about her overall and her kind of position in the campaign right now. She's also someone who you would think would use the debates as a rallying point. You can imagine things getting nasty between Biden and Sanders. Sanders, by the way, they both come in the debate with a certain amount of pressure. I think Biden because he's the front runner, it's his first big test. And Bernie, because all of a sudden now, half the time in these polls, he's polling behind Warren. And so that's a problem for him. So you can imagine Harris or maybe Buttigieg kind of emerging and saying, I'm going to be above the fray, or I don't know. Or maybe Harris wants to be like, you know what? I am obviously a better candidate than either of these old white dudes on stage. And so it's a big night for Harris, whose favorable ratings are perfectly good and who raised enough money, right? But like, seems like she's behind three or four other people in terms of first choice support to like actually show who she is as a candidate and what she's made of.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. And as Claire mentioned, we are going to be live blogging both nights of debate. So tune in for that. And we're also going to have a reaction podcast or two. We haven't exactly figured out our plans yet, but get ready for that as well. Now let's move on and talk about persuadable voters in 2020. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. It's time for spring cleaning. In fact, you only have about 4 days left, I think, technically. Quip's got an easy way to start with that spring cleaning, and it's with your brushing habits. Just 2 minutes twice a day can help you pave the way to a healthier mouth. And now the whole family can get refreshed with Quip. The new Kids Quip has the same 2-minute timer and guiding pulses as their original version, with no childish gimmicks, so they can brush just like a grown-up. The new brush is the same as their original version, just tweaked for size-down mouths. Kids are inspired to brush better and more often with oral care that looks and feels like the products the adults in their lives use. Brush heads are delivered automatically on a dentist-recommended schedule of every 3 months for just $5. That's why over 1 million happy, healthy mouths love Quip. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/538, that's the numbers, not the letters, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack for free at getquip.com, getquip.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs flexible workspace for businesses of all sizes and industries. WeWork spaces are designed to help maximize workplace efficiency, employee effectiveness, team collaboration, and creativity. It's the perfect solution for medium, large, and enterprise businesses that intend to expand into new cities and continents with ease. Looking for an office with a view of Lima, London, Melbourne, or Mumbai? WeWork now has over 400 locations in 100 different cities worldwide. Membership plans are completely flexible, and workspaces are designed to grow with your team. WeWork's floor mapping technology is used to build out custom private floors for larger teams, perfectly designed to fit your business's continuously evolving needs. WeWork pays special attention to the culture and energy in each of their locations, designed to foster amazing partnerships and collaborations both within teams and across companies. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you and learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. As Democrats gear up for the debates, President Trump is gearing up for the general election. He's kicking off his reelection campaign in Orlando on Tuesday. And for all the news that's come out of the Trump White House over the past couple years, his approval has been relatively stable. So as Trump focuses on reassembling his winning coalition, we want to know who exactly the campaign is trying to convince, and of course, who Democrats are trying to convince as well. So we're going to talk about those persuadable voters, swing voters, whatever you want to call them. Just out of the gates here, do you guys have a conception of who the persuadable voters are in 2020, what they look like both either politically or demographically?
They're the Obama-Trump voter, right? I mean, that's my visualization of them. So people who were historically Democrats who voted for Barack Obama and who switched over in 2016, most of them still like Donald Trump. But I think the 2018 midterms showed that there was room for Democrats to potentially perform well among those voters. And I think there were places in swing states like Ohio and Pennsylvania where Democrats performed much better than 2016. And so I think that that's where the movement is, perhaps in a super polarized America.
Do we view also Romney Clinton or Romney third party voters as persuadable voters in 2020?
Less so.
I think they're more solidly moving towards Democrats is my trend impression.
I think it's mostly a mistake to be overly narrow in your conception of who persuadable voters are. So one thing I've tried to do in the past is you'll take a big survey and you run a demographic regression saying, okay, here are a bunch of characteristics we know about someone, everything from age and gender and religion to what part of the country they live in to are they in a union, are they a military veteran, are they gay, all this stuff, right? And you can say, okay, who are the people who come out closest to like 50-50 in terms of their likelihood of voting for Democrat or Republican? And it's actually a pretty good mix, right? In general, you can like mix any two characteristics. Say someone who is an Hispanic but working class. One of those predicts Democratic voting, one predicts Republican voting, at least for Trump, right? Or someone who is wealthy but lives in an urban area or like in a well-educated suburb or something. Those might also contradict one another a little bit in terms of who they might vote for. And so I think the universe of like persuadable voters is broad. I think that pollsters who get too cute about identifying soccer moms or or Little League dads or whatever else, right? Maybe do a disservice where we don't necessarily know ahead of time kind of where the tipping point is.
I agree with that. I would come at this from a few different ways. Obama-Trump voters represent, I think, according to one of the analyses we were looking at, about 5% of the electorate. And, you know, they've gone from having upwards of like 80, 90% approval of Trump down to just like a small majority. So like around 60% approval of Trump. That's a not a huge group of voters, but that's a meaningful change among an important group. I would also look at it in different ways. So like the Democracy Fund voter study group had a thing showing that just 15% of Americans have changed their view of Trump at some point in the last 2 years. So that's like a decent proxy for who's swingable, you know, persuadable. Or like, you know, around 10% of Democrats say the country is on the right track, that the economy is getting better. And a little more than that, say, of Democrats say their family is in a better off position financially. That's a group that I would pay attention to as maybe one where Trump can make progress at. I would look at multiple groups and not just try to identify demographic groups, but also look at questions where you see movement or questions where a group of voters' answer conflicts with their partisan default. The other thing I would say is Catalyst did this really interesting study where they were looking at 2018 versus 2016. And one reason Democrats did so good is there was this group that they called surge voters, people who didn't vote in 2016 but did vote in 2018, which is really interesting because usually presidential years have much higher turnout than midterm years. And so I think that group, in my head at least, and I don't have proof for this, but in my head, that's like a group who was
holding their nose and didn't want to vote for either of the polarizing candidates in 16, but liked voting for more palatable local candidates in 18.
And maybe were sort of energized or just engaged in some way by the Trump presidency. At the same time, like non-college white turnout dropped in 2018 relative to 2016. And so what do those voters do in 2020 now that Trump is on the ballot?
I think strategically the Trump campaign has a lot of potential to run a super interesting 2020 campaign, right? The idea that they could go after people who cultivate the people who were, you know, the underpolled demographics in this 16 election. Like, I think they have a lot of interesting places to go as far as their strategy. I mean, I know we spend a lot of time right now focusing on the Democrats, but I do think the president's path to victory is really interesting.
And to that point, last week on Thursday, I spoke to Republican strategist Bill McInturff. And one of the demographics that he was saying he was looking at in his research, which actually also gets into what Nate was saying about conflicting demographic points, were men of color, so Hispanic and African-American men. He said this somewhat depended on who the Democratic nominee was, but like especially if it was a woman, he saw fertile ground amongst that group for Republicans. Have we seen reason to believe that so far in the polling?
Trump got higher than expected Latino turnout, actually.
Well, I think it's kind of debatable. I think it's relying a lot on the exit polls. I think they're not necessarily all that reliable to break down the Latino vote.
Would it be misguided for Republican strategists or the Trump campaign to think that they could pick up voters in that group?
No, I would buy that. I think there are.
Yeah,
let me put it really generally. Which I think there are men who would vote Republican if there's a woman on the ballot who otherwise wouldn't.
I think maybe what that Republican pollster is getting at is that yes, if the Democratic nominee were a woman, there are certain demographic groups in America that are more culturally conservative and that you could potentially like pick off certain voters of that group by playing up basically on innate sexism that might run through those demographic groups.
Right. And also like white men are already overwhelmingly voting for Republicans
exactly.
So the more fertile ground would be among those men of color.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a concept that's a little bit hard to articulate, but I'm going to try, right? Which is that even if a group overall in the aggregate leans one way or the other, plenty of individual members of that group can still be swing voters, right? So if you do like a chart showing every white man in America and what do they vote for, like 70% for Trump, right? And if you do to be very geeky about like a kernel distribution where you show each individual's probability of voting Democrat or Republican, you still have a pretty thick size of that constituency over the 50-50 mark. And I think there's too much demographic determinism in the way people vote, because in the aggregate, yeah, it's very important that 2/3 or 7 out of 10 white voters vote for Trump, white men. At the same time, the 30% who don't are really quite important, actually. That's still a big number. The 30-ish, 25-ish percent of Hispanics who do not vote for Democrats is a pretty big number, actually, right? And so, I don't know, I think there's like too much determinism. And like, in general, if you kind of remove black voters from the equation, because black voters are so Democratic that even if you need like a lot of things to contradict that for them to consider voting Republican, and maybe the equivalent to black voters is white evangelicals, especially in the South, where they're so anti-Democrat, at least for the type of Democrats that would be nominated for the presidential nomination, that like, okay, fewer of them are in play. Apart from those two groups, I think it's probably pretty even kind of, and probably resembles the general population more than you would think in terms of who is persuadable.
So then why do we see these elections that seem to be so divided along these demographic lines where you can look and say, okay, you're an urban dwelling, college educated white person, you probably voted for Hillary Clinton. Okay, you are a working class white person in the Rust Belt, you probably voted for Donald Trump. How do we square those two things that actually, like, a lot of America is persuadable, but only 15% of Americans have changed their opinion about Trump over the past 2.5 years. And also, when we actually have elections, it just seems to fall very much along these demographic lines.
Because it's a matter of micro versus macro, right? When you look macro out, yeah, you know, generally, if you have an urban younger millennial, then you're probably a Clinton voter or Democrat, right? And maybe she wins those voters 70-30 or something. But at an individual level, 70-30 is still millions of people. And also individually, that consists of some people who are 100 and some people who are 40, right? And some people who are like kind of close to the median. That's like why it's a little hard to articulate. But like if literally you go into a data set and try and forecast on an individual voter level who is persuadable, you wind up with a more diverse definition of persuadable voters than you would think by looking at macro level data.
Is it more than 15% of Americans?
I don't know if it's more or less. Maybe 15% is about the right number. But remember, people all have multiple demographic characteristics. You have race, gender, religion, age, sexuality, which party you belong to, whether you think of yourself as liberal or moderate. Education is an increasingly important one. And so, like, people are complex, and swing voters are complex, and often they have contradictory demographic characteristics.
Yeah, so just a few things. So one is, the swing here overall we're talking about, it's not huge swings. Democrats won the national House vote by like 8-9 points in 2018. So 2018, big year for Democrats. They win the House. They pick up a bunch of governorships, et cetera, right? Clinton won the national popular vote in 2016 by 2 points. So that's like a 6-7 point difference, right? Even though it's not a huge share of the country that's persuadable, it's still more than enough to shift elections from what we all would describe as Democratic landslide to Republican landslide, at least in the context of today. The other thing is there are multiple layers of swinging going on here.
Sounds not exactly appropriate for primetime.
There are multiple, because it's turnout and persuasion. In other words, is the campaign and are the candidates persuading people to turn out and vote? And then are those actors persuading people to vote for them or the other person? That creates more fluidity in the system than if it was just what do people think. Democrats lost rural areas in 2016. They lost rural areas in 2018, but they lost rural areas in 2018 by less than they did in 2016, partly because of persuasion and partly because of turnout. And that was really important in some House races and governor's races, and again, could be really important in like some of these Rust Belt states. It's just there's a lot more fluidity and complexity than just like, can I convince person X to change their mind from, you know, from Trump to Biden or whomever?
So let's close on this, and maybe I don't know if there is an answer, but when looking at persuasion versus turnout in an environment where maybe 10 to 15% of people are persuadable, is it fair to say that turnout is more important than persuasion, or is that kind of like a trap that people fall into when they just think, oh, everyone's already made up their mind, so all you have to do is turn out the people who already agree with you?
I think it's a bit of a trap. One of the storylines that I've seen, at least in the Democratic primary side of things, for a really long time, basically since the last election, is almost this dichotomy between we got to win back Obama-Trump voters, and that means we have to nominate a white guy, or nope, we have to nominate a person of color and activate those communities. Like, there does seem to be this real bifurcated conversation, and not that you need to perhaps consider both options. So I think that there's just like a weirdly bifurcated conversation about it's either turnout or it's either persuading those people who switched allegiances.
How often does the same party make gains in both turnout and persuasion in election relative to the last election?
Pretty odd. I mean, they tend to be correlated, right? And if you're doing well, you usually both persuade new people to vote for you and get more people to turn out. Turnout versus persuasion is like way too abstract a question. Like, that's not an answerable question, right? You know, is, you know, what's more important in a marriage, physical romance or financial security? It's like just way too open-ended.
Physical romance.
Okay.
Sorry, gold diggers.
Looks like we answered the question. And with that,
that was an easy question.
What I do think is that, like, the conventional wisdom is over-indexed toward turnout, in part because if you're a political partisan, then you can say, okay, if I just kind of double down on the things my base likes, then that will actually help me more than trying to pander to the center or whatever. And so I think the Ingram bias is toward partisans believing that, hey, if I can just kind of turn out the true believers, then therefore I'll do better, when probably it's a mix of both. But I think more often than not, these kind of base strategies, like, frankly, like the Republicans tried in 2018, more often than not, they backfire, because there are two ways they can backfire. You can either motivate the other party's base, or you can anti-persuade swing voters. First, the benefit of, like, okay, I do appeal to my base, but you gain in one way and lose in two others. And so therefore, like, I think parties don't often account for that. And they forget that for the most part, the things that rile up your base also rile up the other party's base. Maybe there are some issues, like traditionally gun control was one where Republicans gained more with their base because they gave it higher salience than Democrats did with their base. So therefore, there might be some exceptions to that, and a skilled political practitioner could identify those.
Yeah, I think the fact that turnout and persuasions, those gains tend to be correlated, betrays the fact that there's like something bigger going on here. We tend to talk about elections, as Claire was saying, as if like the campaigns have these like two levers they can pull, turnout, persuasion. But it's more just like what's going on in the country, who's speaking better to that moment, and, you know, other kind of candidate characteristics and economic conditions and all the rest. And that filters down into turnout and persuasion. We should get out of the habit of talking about the campaign as if these candidates can pull a turnout lever or a persuasion lever, and those things are independent or all that exact.
All right. Well, I think that is a good place to leave it. So hopefully we've answered the question of who is persuadable in 2020. It's a lot of people. Let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you. We missed you. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.